Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode 107, Spectropolis. I'm your co-host Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik, and today our guest is Josh Komaroff. He is the author of Spectropolis, The Enchantment of Capital in Singapore. Josh is a professor at National University of Singapore, and he is the co-author of Horror in Architecture, which some of you more itinerant listeners may remember from a previous episode, which was also quite fascinating. It does seem there's an interest in the macabre running through his work, and we're very happy to have him back today. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I wanted to start off by asking about Spectropolis, okay? I guess we have to first define what we mean by a Spectropolis. It seems that you've identified an abiding irony in the built environment of Singapore, which everyone, I think, internationally thinks of as being a very controlled environment, very modern, the most modern of nations, the most assertively modern of nations. And yet, there is a thread of superstition that seems to run through the real estate business, which is quite intense. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that in broad terms, and then we can get into the specifics.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think you described it really well, Daniel. I mean, there is this interesting contradiction at work because, you know, we tend to think of Singapore, there's immediately that association with what everyone's seen typically online, right? The sort of gleaming high-tech skyline, all of those kind of highly imageable, iconic buildings, and the sense that the place is run in a very kind of machine-like and hyper-rational way, right? And at the same time, I think people don't know this very strong undercurrent of popular religion in which a lot of that is really seen to be in a way affected by, or in some cases determined by, a kind of a deep kind of spiritual world. So that there's this sense that the city itself is related in many of its ways, especially in its speculative modes, right? In terms of property development, in terms of the marketplace, in terms of financial investments, which is really, you know, that's what the city's about, right? It's a hub for that kind of business. And a lot of the outcomes of those by many people who are involved are seen to in some ways be subject to the whims of ghosts, of literal specters, of the ghosts of, you know, people who have lived and died on the island, right? And so Spectropolis is really an attempt to kind of come to terms with that contradiction and kind of ask why this would be the case. So the term Spectropolis itself is kind of has a double meaning. One is about specters, right? And the spectral and the role of the specters and spectral in modern capital, which we tend to think of as kind of very disenchanted, right? And at the same time, the other spec there is speculation. And specters and speculation are seen to have a very, very clear and instrumental relationship in this context. And that's what I try and kind of unpack in the book. And the idea is that the city in many ways, despite its image, despite its obviously very clear, solid, modernist materiality, has that this kind of pulse, this like hidden kind of energy that is inside it and is in many ways fueled by religious concepts that are very old, but also economic concepts that are very new. And the way that these things come together to me is just, it's just a fascinating subject. And it's something I've been thinking about and researching for over 20 years now.
Okay, so there's a great term that appears in this, which is hell money. Can you tell us what hell money is?
Hell money, yeah. Well, hell money is an interesting, it's a subset of money, generally kind of a very long-standing tradition. So I should just say here that this is all set within the context of what in Singapore is called Chinese religion. It's just an old term. It's not a very good term, but it's a term that everybody uses. And what it refers to is a long history of really syncretic religion that takes place, which is, you know, somewhat Taoist, somewhat Buddhist, somewhat Confucian. It's a lot of different ideas that come together because in Singapore, what we have is a long history of migration of Chinese communities, what are called Nanyang communities, that come from southern China and move throughout Southeast Asia, mainly for trade, but also as part of the British Empire. And then they start to mix in really interesting ways culturally with, you know, Malay communities, Javanese communities, Indian communities, all. So it's tons of migrants, and then there are indigenous populations, and all kinds of things come together. And you get this interesting belief system, which is kind of, you know, in Singapore they describe it, they use the term rojak. Rojak is like it's a salad that has lots of different ingredients. And the idea is kind of like, you know, it's a little bit, to go back to the horror and architecture language, a little bit of a kind of a Frankenstein thing, but in a very positive way, right? And so within Chinese religion, there's a very long-standing set of traditions that have to do with making offerings to ancestors. And there are specific paper goods, money, commodities, and things that for hundreds and thousands of years, people burn for ancestors to provide for them in the afterlife. So there are different forms of this that I talk about in the book, but a very modern version is what's called hell money. And this is the kind of the cheap, fast money that you can just pick up at a lot of places throughout Singapore and local markets, in little shops here and there. And it literally looks like, in many cases, American money. In other cases, it's kind of wildly embellished, or it's more kind of Asian. Sometimes it looks like Chinese yuan. But it's this currency that comes in big stacks. It's printed on printer paper. It looks like bills, but it has these really wild denominations. So, you'll often find, I think the highest I found this last year was a sextillion dollar bill. And the idea is that you burn this, and what it does is it remits value to your ancestors in the afterlife after you burn it, and it gives them lots and lots of money to kind of elevate their status, to elevate their degree of comfort, and to make their afterlife, generally a more happy and wealthy experience. So hell money is, it's something where we see it throughout the year in various kinds of ritual formats, and it's always being burned. But there's this particular time of the year in the Chinese calendar. It's the seventh lunar month, what's called Ghost Month in Singapore, kind of colloquially, which is a very kind of haunted and somber time of the year because it's believed that the gates of hell open and all of the ghosts and many of the ancestors kind of return to the city. And at that time, they're around. And what you want to do is to make sure to burn a lot of money to make sure that they're, taken care of and they're happy and they stay away from mischief, because there's also a high sense that there's risk. The ghosts also can do things to you that you don't want. So hell money is one of the ways to kind of generally sort of keep them happy. So people buy it in big stacks and they burn it in big stacks, along with other kinds of interesting things. Like, you'll see paper versions of almost everything, paper cars, paper iPads, paper iPods, very modern sort of commodities that when you first look at them, you think they're the real thing, but actually what they are just these clever printed kind of cardboard versions of those things. And you can get Hermes shirts and Rolex watches and all the different brands of kind of electronics and things. And those are also burned because apparently the ancestors really kind of want to stay up to date in terms of their material life.
Have you ever heard of a situation where an offering didn't work, or where something mysterious happened on a site as a consequence of not having followed the rituals?
Yeah, this is a really interesting subject, right? Because the ghosts are famously kind of ornery and whimsical, right? So the idea is that if you burn offerings for ghosts, a few different things can happen, right? One is just that they'll leave you alone, right? Which everyone wants, right? Nobody wants, because the penalties for having upset the ghosts or having the ghosts sort of come after you, whether it's a kind of targeted attack or whether this is just kind of you upset them or you were disrespectful in some ways. I mean, they're wonderful stories. And I spent for this book, basically, from the time I was doing doctoral research in the early 2000s until, last year, talking to Singaporeans about their experiences with ghosts. And of course, everybody knew somebody who had, accidentally upset a ghost, and then they got this sort of weird, these weird kind of complexes of illnesses and symptoms and things that happen to people, which are basically kind of a ghostly fugue state that's kind of put on you. So you can ward off this kind of ill fortune by burning things, but generally by being respectful, right? But you can also use this in various ways to kind of prevent accidents, and in certain cases we can talk about a little bit later, to kind of court ghosts in certain kinds of transactions, right? To make sure that things that you're doing in this world turn out well. Speculations, stock market, positions, development, as you mentioned just now, Daniel, of construction sites. So one of the major areas in which this is this happens is in a very high risk thing, which is the construction of Singapore's very large, often buildings, right? And these are not just large, technically complicated, potentially dangerous, like all construction sites, but also tend to be places where, often billions of dollars are at risk. So making sure that the ghosts are on your side and they intervene in your favor and they don't, cause accidents on the construction site or cause the property to fail when it, goes to market is a really big aspect of this. So yes, there are lots of examples. There are always positive and negative ones because ghosts very much become a mode of explaining kind of idiosyncratic risk of different kinds. And that could just be risk in real life. So very often when something unexpected befalls somebody or there's a mysterious illness no one can explain or, you know, people do all the right things, but bad things happen to them, right? The classic, like, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do bad things happen to deeply religious people? There are things that go wrong. And some of them have interesting cultural nuances. Like, one of the cases I talk about in the book is a woman who for years is trying to kind of propitiate the spirit to get it to leave her alone because it keeps kind of irritating people, you know, around her house and, you know, to her helpers, her domestic helpers. And she is constantly offering food, which is another thing you can do, right? You light joss sticks and you offer food. And, you know, because a spirit medium had told her offhand that this is what she had to do, and everyone knows it, right? So she did this. And years later, a Malay Bomo, which is a spirit doctor of a kind of slightly different cultural tradition, came in and said, well, what are you feeding her? And she said, I feed her what we eat, you know, pork and rice. And she said, no, the ghost is Malay. You can't feed a Muslim ghost, you know, pork and, you know, these kinds of things. So, you know, there are different ways in which that can go wrong. And of course, ghosts are whimsical, right? They're assumed to be in this tradition very much like people. So if you give somebody something they don't want, you know, it's like giving somebody socks for their birthday. I mean, I personally like socks for my birthday, but, you know, giving them something that they think is like not an appropriate gift or not a gift of high enough status or the wrong kind of thing often can have unintended effects. So when you deal with a ghost, you're always dealing with a certain degree of unpredictability and whimsy.
So how does this play out in Singapore's built form in both the micro and the macro? I'd love to know, are there examples of project failures, et cetera, that are attributed to failure of lack of supplicating to a ghost and are infamous for that reason? But then also, like, how you see sort of Singapore, its context, as you discuss in the book, of its sort of its ecology and how this sort of combines together. You assert that, like, you know, the Kuhlhaas was wrong in his famous essay about Singapore and SMLXL, that it's never a tabula rasa, but you compare it to a hedgerow maze. I was wondering if you could unpack that about how this all gets channeled. Like, how does spirituality define this hyper-modernist built form?
Yeah. I mean, those are both super interesting questions. In the first case, yeah, there are, of course, there's a massive, I don't want to call it like a rumor mill, but there are these, you know, endless cultural discourses, urban myths, you know, casual chatter about, you know, why do certain buildings succeed and other buildings fail? You know, why do some things become international icons while other things just sort of, you know, look right, tick all the boxes? I mean, there was a case of this with like a very big condominium that was right next to a hospital. And it was built, and it was on the perfect piece of land, the perfect location, the perfect price point. I mean, it was very expensive, but, you know, everything in Singapore is very expensive, right? So the idea was that, you know, everything was going the right way. They'd done the work that developers do to make success. And then, you know, when it hit the market, just nothing. Like, it just sat there, nothing sold. And I think eventually it was bought up by like a distressed assets fund or something like that, which is always when that happens and people look and they're like, oh, it's in the right place, in the right time. You know, and so it turns out that, you know, a few blocks down, there's a hospital. And the idea was that somehow that this was a kind of a nexus of like really intense spiritual activity. And a lot of the contractors said that they just hadn't done the work to kind of purify the site because there was so much intensity because people die in hospitals, right? People get sick in hospitals. And if you look at this from another lens that feeds into this so-called kind of Chinese religion matrix of beliefs, which is, you know, geomancy, the whole kind of feng shui tradition and the ecology, which you asked about, and I'll mention a bit more about in a moment, but the idea that human suffering in a place contributes to a kind of energetic load that in many cases is seen to attract other negative energies and can attract ghosts of the wrong kind to itself. So, of course, when people looked at this, they kind of very quickly said, like, the only explanation has to be a spiritual explanation, right? And this often is an accusation that, you know, we see it. It kind of tends to gravitate to, you know, old houses that remain empty because the assumption is that there's so much history that they must be haunted, right? If people have been living in a place for long enough, there's enough social drama, enough divorce, enough, you know, domestic violence, and, you know, whatever, all this kind of sediment of kind of bad human interaction tends to have, for various reasons, kind of draw ghosts to itself and create hauntings, and that then directly affects the valuation of those properties, their ability to be sold, because in this discourse, right, in this kind of religious frame, the notion is that ghosts and value are very directly related. So, you know, good energy, good interaction with the spirit world will boost the value of things in an extraordinarily exponential way, almost like those zeros on the hell money, right? The whole notion is that, like, when you're dealing with, like, ghostly powers, value just skyrockets, but it can also go the other way, right? You can get massive collapses, devaluations, kind of idiosyncrasies or distortions in the market that are the work of the spirit world and the way that it's interacting more generally with the energies of places and the way that they sit in a kind of a matrix of a geomantic sort of theory, right? So, yeah, old houses, you know, things like police stations, place like, you know, the cases that I heard about over and over again in the construction industry, which of course is like the center of buzz for ghostly stories because it's where everyone has some skin in the game, everyone's really concerned, everyone's been affected by it. And so what tends to happen is that projects like that everyone knows will have certain kind of dark elements or elements of concern. So there was a famous police station that was built where for years people who were working there were getting mysterious illnesses. There was this can manifest in a lot of different ways, right? Ghosts can come after you in a lot of different ways. And like, so people were having cases of infertility, right? The staff were unable to conceive kids. The ones who did have kids, the kids were doing mysteriously badly, even though they were studying really hard. There were all of these stories about kind of bad luck, right? Generally speaking, this manifests in very, very bad luck. And they eventually brought in a kind of a multi-faith religious team, what's often called a kind of a ghost-busting team, colloquially. And they came in and they determined that the evidence room, where there was all of these kind of objects that had been involved in crimes and violence of various kinds, was just such emitting such an enormous kind of dark energy that was attracting ghosts to itself, and that was then negatively affecting everybody who was working in that building and also their families and because this has a kind of a powerfully infective kind of associative, you know, magic to it. And so there are lots and lots of buildings that for various reasons and in different ways and become unveiled in this kind of mode of explanation, which is really interesting. And so I think, you know, what's really interesting about this is that then, of course, as I just mentioned with the police station, as you'd imagine, you know, Singapore is a very powerful, soft authoritarian, rather illiberal, kind of centralized, powerfully administered state with a government that has incredible capacity to manage and run and also to keep order. But also what the government has done, of course, is to take the whole island and effectively completely transform it, right? What happens in the post-independence years up till today, massive land reclamation, a lot of what people don't think about when they think about modern Singapore is a lot of that land that these incredible towers and business complexes are sitting on used to be Chinese graveyards and Muslim and Malay graveyards, in some cases Jewish graveyards. I mean, every kind of migrant group that was in Singapore had their graveyards. And these were incredibly land intensive on a very small island. And so in the post-war, the People's Action Party, the PAP, who are the kind of the ruling party since independence and still to today, they realized they had to disinter a lot of these graves or most of these graves. So we have few patches of them left over, but the modern city is literally built on former grave sites, right? And as you can imagine in kind of this kind of folk or popular imaginary, like, this means that any site that you live on could have been a graveyard. Any train station you move through could have been a graveyard. And so there are all of these stories that have to do with that and with a kind of return of the repressed, right? The ghosts who are now made homeless by this massive state project of construction because it causes all this disturbance, because they disinter graves, because there's a kind of complete, like from a geomantic or like feng shui standpoint, like this is causing incredible amounts of disturbance ecologically, in terms of human life patterns, in terms of kind of historical sediment, in terms of like the balance of different materials and tree species and everything. The whole massive reconstruction is seen on the one hand as, you know, a triumphant discourse of modernization, possibly the great, most successful example that we have in the world in such a short time in a particular place like Southeast Asia. But then at the same time, by many people, especially people who are from this kind of Chinese faith, this is seen as a massive ghost production exercise, right? All you're doing with all of this is just disturbing, you know, digging up graves, you know, creating all of this stuff where there used to be a kind of a balance and a longstanding kind of historical ecology. And part of what the book deals with is like, what is that conception of ecology? How do ghosts, money, trees, stone, water, orientations in the compass, how does all of this come together in a way that, for example, when you're dealing with a spirit medium, they can come to a site and look at its history and look at its condition and say, oh, this is likely to be very haunted, or you have to burn a lot of money to start. And this is, of course, seen as, you know, both crisis and opportunity. On the one hand, it's disturbance, and disturbance brings in spirits. But then on the other, you know, you have a lot of spirits who you can then work to kind of make happy, and you can, you know, work with them, and you can transact with them, and you can, you know, offer them many kinds of things, social respect, but also commodities and money that allow them to then help you in the process of development, help you in the process of modernization. So it's a very interesting kind of complicated cycle of forces that interact with each other.
I'm wondering if in the effect on the built environment, I'm just musing about the different ways this could go. You have seen any examples of something that was built that probably wouldn't have been built if people had not consulted with the spirit guide or with, in some ways, with the spirit world. I'm thinking, you know, of my only convenient corollary is the Winchester Mystery House in San Jose, California, where a medium had told an heiress that she had to keep building for her entire life in order to misdirect the spirits that were on the site. And she did, and it's a very weird place. I'm wondering if you'd seen any places like that in Singapore, which is so rationalized, you know, with you know, commodity, you know, units stacked on top of each other, and land is so, so scarce. I'm just wondering if you had seen anything like a mystery house or weird jigs in the hall or things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that there are, and again, this is a wonderful site of storytelling, right? Of narrative, specifically in the construction industry, right? Where a lot of people will speculate, you know, well, why does the building look like that? Or have been directly involved in projects where spirit mediums come in. And the spirit mediums are major kind of protagonists in the book, in part because they do a lot of work as, in effect, kind of like ombudsmen or like go-betweens, you know, between the developers and the contractors in particular and the spirit world, right? So the site becomes a space of negotiation. And there are many cases in which people came back and said, you know, the medium would come back and say, this is a very problematic site. There are ghosts here who feel that they have real ownership of the site. You're going to have to do a lot of work. You're going to have to do this and that, but you're also going to have to maintain a certain kind of like energetic balance or a certain kind of architectural design in conjunction with certain regular religious activities, with rituals, rites, and so on. So if you want this to work, there are a lot of things you're going to have to do. And so very often, like, the forms of particular buildings were informed by geomantic theory in a way to try and create a site that would have a certain kind of energetic condition, which is directly affected by, obviously, the form of the architecture, right? In feng shui theory and geomantic theory, the way that the building is oriented, the kind of materials it uses, the nature of its geometry, like whether it has kind of sharp, acute corners or more kind of, you know, right angles or more obtuse geometries, or whether they're curved, you know, how they interact with natural elements on the site, whether you build parks or water features, like all of these kinds of things play a role. And there's a very direct kind of deterministic relationship between that kind of, you know, constructed form and the way that it will perform spiritually and thus by association economically, right? And that's the big question. And so very often, you know, so there's a famous example was Neon City, which is one of the kind of the big abiding kind of economic powerhouse malls in the city. It's still a place where all these major brands are. It's where, you know, I don't know, I won't reel off brands, but, you know, super high end. And then a kind of a gradation because it has an enormous tenant mix down to kind of everyday things like bubble tea shops and things that people want. And there is a whole kind of plaza, a courtyard on the front that had to do with managing the history of that site as a spectral problem. And so it's also a site where there was a lot. So, you know, here, like geomantic theory, feng shui, the design of the building, and then enormous kind of annual careful observation of certain kind of rites, especially at certain times of the year that are very associated with ghosts and ancestors, also would happen. A Chinese New Year, so the handoff of the old year and the new year is a very kind of important, quite serious kind of moment, which has to be handled carefully. You know, and to most of the world and to outsiders like myself who kind of come in for years, this just looks like lion dances and a lot of things being burnt. But what it is a kind of a very kind of calculated and careful kind of management of that relationship. So there are lots and lots of buildings where you look at the form and you're like, you know, why, right? Like what this, there could have been a much kind of more intuitive use of, you know, distribution of architectural space. And in fact, it turns out that this was under the advice of a medium or under the advice of, you know, a geomantic consultant. And there's a very big, very corporatized field of this kind of advice. And, you know, it plays a very big role in the building industry. And at the same time, you know, sometimes people do this and things still don't work, or they do the wrong kind of thing. So, you know, there was a famous example of this building called the Gateway, which was designed by I.M. Pei. Beautiful building, two towers with those typical, you know, very pointy, acute I.M. Pei corners. And the idea was that a lot of disturbance happened in the buildings that were kind of facing those corners, or which those corners were facing, because when you turn from a 90 degree angle to a very acute angle, you create something called arrow chi, or like it's a kind of like, it almost like intensifies the energy. It's kind of like shooting energy with a high intensity because of the nature of that geometric corner. So it was almost like having kind of like a ray gun pointed at you. And the rumors in the construction industry were always that the buildings that were facing that experienced all kinds of, you know, bad events, financial downturn. They couldn't make their businesses work. And it was all because I.M. Pei's building was firing bad chi in their direction, you know. So it's interesting. It works in the flip side where, again, it becomes a mode of explanation for when, you know, when things don't work or when things were done in a way that anyone who looks at that building that comes from a kind of a geomantic discipline would look at that and go, nah, that's a bad idea. And the idea that it was, again, a kind of a Chinese-American architect that did that was, you know, as you can imagine, extremely ironic.
You know, I worked and lived in China for 2 years, and I've been to Singapore a number of times, and my daily work is dealing with, you know, architects' outputs and their publicity and the developers' publicity about their buildings, and I have never encountered this. I mean, other than hearing about feng shui generally and understanding feng shui principles do guide the design of floor plans, all these rituals and this geomantic stuff, it is not talked about, or it is not presented. Like, you don't see these people in a consultant stack when they talk about everyone who worked on a building.
That's what I want to know more about. Like, who is a geomantic consultant, and like, where are they in the line items or like the staffing? Like, I mean, do they get their own field there? And like, you know, you see org charts where like, here's our geomantic consultant and you will be reporting to them kind of thing.
That's a fascinating question. And, you know, again, this plays out in a lot of different ways, right? Because, you know, our developers and our contractors are coming from all over in terms of like their own kind of faith traditions, right? So there are projects in which none of this happens, right? In my experience, it's relatively rare that at some point there isn't a site ceremony, a spirit medium, a geomantic consultant at some point in the process. But what's fascinating is that this is a kind of a shadow consultant team, right? There's a whole kind of series of things that happen, and it has to, in a sense, be handled very carefully and in some cases very quietly, because the minute that people know, for example, that there was an accident on a construction site, the assumption is going to be, first of all, that this might be ghostly intervention of some kind. And that does not bode well, right? Like, unless that's handled super well, what that tends to suggest is problems down the line. And those problems, again, are very contagious in nature. So that can be the devaluation of a project. And again, remember, if this is happening for a project that's releasing on the market a year and a half later or a year later when the units can be sold, if that gets out, it can really affect the sales of that unit. It can also be seen to affect the lives of the people who live in that building. What's very interesting is that the building is seen as a kind of a complex social compact or contract between everybody involved. So when you're involved in site ceremonies, the medium will very often tell you, we need everybody, we need all the consultants. And that's at the moment where you see the whole org chart. I mean, I've been on sites where you see everybody from the developer, CEO, even sometimes the really high up members of the contractor. In some cases, these were Japanese contractors where the people who came in, you know, they might have been in town, it could have been scheduled because of their, you know, their availability. But, you know, very, very high level people, all the way down to all the contractors, the architects, the landscape architects, the engineers, everybody. And the idea was that eventually, you know, depending on how well or poorly this was managed, this would directly affect the people who live in the units. It would affect the developer. It would affect their other projects that they're working on, right? So what happens in terms of the spirit world then kind of very quickly ramifies outwards, right? It's like ripples in a pond, affects everybody in some way. So, you know, you can imagine if it's bad news, how badly that can affect everyone's perception of the project and everyone's sense, you know, the sense of morale about what everybody's doing, right? So we have to kind of make sure that that's handled. But then also it can be a public relations thing. Like there are many cases of developers spreading rumors about other developers about, you know, things, mysterious things that happened on site or mysterious things that happened to tenants when a project, when they first started moving in, because it's a kind of economic sabotage, right? It's a great form of rumor mongering that makes people feel like, oh, you know, if I'm choosing between two condos and that one has some kind of rumors about kind of spectral ill will, like I'll avoid that one, I'll go for this one, right? So it's something that people can kind of leverage on quite easily. So it's a very interesting thing that there is this kind of secondary trade, which is very, very important, but its main job is almost like, it's kind of like the spiritual version of like the fire department or a kind of insurance company. It's like there to make sure that, you know, what everyone sort of knows is going to happen sooner or later, something that is attributed to the spirit world is handled in a way that doesn't then create problems for the project. And if anything, can turn it around, right? So I talk in the book about these interviews where I followed this one spirit medium around, and he kept saying, well, yeah, okay, so this starts out as bad. There's something on the site that looks problematic. But then, you know, when I work with it, I make the energy so good that people will pay 10, 15% above the market price. When they live there, they feel amazing. They have lots of kids generally. And, you know, a lot of this, again, and this is a very complex discourse, right? I think it's a pretty dense book. But what starts to happen is this is translated into the language of luck, right? So one of the ways that you kind of understand how things are going in your relationship with ghosts is like, you know, are your stocks going up or down? You know, are your bets at the casino, like, coming back good, or are you losing a lot of money? You know, generally speaking, are there patterns of good things happening or bad things happening? And this is a term huat, right? Or sway. You know, things are either lucky or unlucky. And that's sort of how you know. Now, what's interesting, to go back to your question more kind of directly, is that we see developers who are not from this belief system, right? There are many developers like, you know, who are, for example, evangelical. And they don't like this stuff. So what starts to happen is the contractors quietly do it. Like they're not allowed to have, there's some developers that won't allow shrines on a site. You have to have a shrine on a site, right? And so what the contractors would do would be to mask the shrine as a kind of like an electrical box or something. And so when the developer would drive by, they would, you know, they would lock it up and then they would open it up again. So sometimes this has to actually be done in a subversive way. And in which case it's paid for by the contractor and the, you know, and they think this is very bad, right? You know, that the developer should at the very least be tolerant of what other people want to believe. But there are a few cases in which that hasn't been the case. And as you can imagine, that becomes a kind of powerful way of explaining why the project succeeded or didn't succeed. And so these have to be delicately and often kind of quietly, at least very tactfully handled.
On the flip side, has there been sabotage? Because, man, I can imagine this too, where you are, you know, deliberately ripping out the shrines, attempting to induce bad luck as well too. Are there cases of this?
I haven't heard of that. And the reason there, I think, is because that bad luck, again, is super contagious. So, you know, if you were to try and sabotage, you know, say you have a developer you're working for and they've stiffed you on, you know, your payments or, you know, whatever, you have a bad relationship and you're like, all right, I'm going to screw over your project. I'm going to take this shrine and I'm going to kick it or I'm going to remove it, you know, and kind of court ill will. The problem is that will most quickly probably hit back on you because you're like at the front line, right? And one of the things where it's really interesting is that, you know, of course, what we have in Singapore is enormous amounts of migrant labor, right? So it's not like you have monolithically Chinese workforces. You have very, very diverse workforces. We have workers from Bangladesh and Pakistan and all over, anywhere where migrant labor can be sourced, right? And so very often there's a kind of an interesting negotiation process. And I've seen this many times where you see the Chinese foreman is telling a bunch of Bangladeshi workers, like, look, I know you don't believe in this, but this is really important. So just kind of bear with us, go along, hold the joystick, say the rights, you know, we'll work with us. It'll be better for everybody. You know, so there's an interesting kind of acculturation process or a negotiation that happens between different kind of religious traditions. And a lot of it tends to be a mix of kind of, let's say, informal, just kind of cultural relativism, right? Like, okay, I don't believe in this, but you do. And I want everyone here to be happy. Nobody wants the idea of a ghost coming and doing all these horrible things. And they all have many stories about, you know, things that did happen that were awful, right? People being crushed by beams. And, you know, a lot of violent things happen on construction sites, right? And then the other side of this relativism is a kind of a Pascal's wager, right? It's like, so what do I have to lose? Like, you know, I say the rights, you know, I burn money, even if I don't myself believe it, somebody else here does, first of all. And second of all, if, you know, what do I have to lose? You know, I could gain from this, but I'm not going to lose from it. And I've heard that I've even heard that from like Christian, like Methodist property developers are like, look, this is all mumbo jumbo to me, but everyone else here believes it. So it's important for morale. And what do I have to lose?
All right, so Josh, my last question is how does this tie in, if at all, to technology as well? So I don't know, this might be a half-baked question, but you know, as Dan knows, I've been working this whole report for the last couple of years thinking about where AI and augmented reality goes. And like, one is the direction of like having AI ghosts in the machine kind of thing. I'm curious from like a cultural perspective, like, does this, you know, obviously they literally believe in the ghost too, but I do wonder, like, if we look forward, there will we have like the AI representations of ghosts? Do we see this get represented into the culture of technology in any way, shape, or form? Because this has been speculated by a lot of people that like we're going to have a re-enchanted world with these kinds of technologies, and like this seems like the place where I would literally like have, you know, meet the ghost of my building when I come in, and it's some sort of AI agent kind of thing like that. I'm just sort of curious like how that ricochets around the Singaporean hypermodernity as well as its sort of ancient custom.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And, you know, one of the things you put your finger on right there, and it's a very rich topic, and I kind of brush up against it quite a bit in the book, is the assumption of some kind of affinity between ghosts and technology. And, you know, we see this, right? There's a whole history of horror movies in which you can only see the ghost on televisual playback. There's a history of kind of spectral studies from the 90s and 2000s where people really talk about it, you know, and some of the history is amazing. Like one of the concerns when they first invented phonograph recording was the concern that they would be able to pick up spectral voices, right? You're going to be able to capture ghosts because ghosts were, you know, the sensitivity of the microphone would be able to pick up the unseen. And, you know, the whole idea is that what spiritual mediums have, people who conduct seances, is a form of sensitivity. And what they're able to see is to see the unseen and to see what's around us. And this has a longstanding history. So again, when I talk about Singaporeans, you know, consulting ghosts at graveyards and making offerings to ask them for stock tips or lottery numbers, this is very often seen as this kind of sort of eccentrically kind of Asian or exotic thing. But this was happening in London in the 19th century with the stock market, right? Spiritualists were conducted. There was the Clayton sisters were these very famous, very extravagant twin sisters who would do kind of give you market insights, right? So forever, and you know, John Calvin, right, hated speculation because he thought that this was interfering into the spirit world and it was a form of kind of hubris. So like, this is an association that is, I think, pan-cultural and goes back a long time, right? But when it comes to technology, this is another really interesting one, right? Where what we start to see is this notion that ghosts and machinery or ghosts and electricity or ghosts and air conditioning have a kind of intimate relationship with each other. So one of the mediums I was talking to was talking about how in the old days, the mediums would practice especially kind of trance states and possession states in public. This was a big kind of form of kind of public spectacle where, you know, the mediums would become possessed and they would inflict pain on themselves and they wouldn't cry out. And these really gruesome kind of torture would take place in public. And at a certain point, the state was like, well, okay, this is getting to be a bit much, guys. And the Singapore state is very, very respectful about religion, right? It's a secular state. It handles religion incredibly carefully. But they were like, you can do this. Maybe just do it inside. And so one of these mediums was asked, you know, what was it like to move inside after all these years of public? And they said, no, actually, you know, the spirits love it inside because there's air conditioning. They like fluorescent light. You know, like, and, you know, when I asked people about this, there were a lot of different explanations. And one was the idea that ghosts are very much like they are literally spectral, like in the sense that they vibrate, right? They are waves, and that they are waves that are not within our visual kind of spectrum. Like we can't see them unless we have special kinds of gifts of sight, but they have an incredible affinity with technology. And this is part of the reason why ghosts love, you know, ancestors love their iPads, love their iPods, love the latest Samsung, you know, I mean, and this is really funny, right? Because when you buy like a paper iPhone, for your ancestor or for, you know, a random ghost that you're trying to kind of offer something to and improve their life. Often it's like the iPhone 25 or the iPhone 32, you know, like their iPhone, the ghost iPhone in the afterlife. It's like China, like their technology is like way higher than what we have here, right? So all the numbers go up, right? And so there is this incredible kind of historical discourse. And so I think what's starting to happen is in many cases, there's a sense that you can use technology, right? They're very often like a lot of the stuff that happens in the seventh month, like these gutai, which is this kind of song stage performance where people sing to entertain the spirits and so on. A lot of the rites, things like that now are happening online. There's a whole like new kind of mode of, I would say kind of like electric kind of geomancy or spiritual mediumship that happens almost entirely through like social media and technology of various kinds. And that's a whole other, it's a whole other story. But the point being that like, I think your intuition on this is absolutely correct. And it's playing into a lot of ways in which this technology is changing. Now, questions about AI are fascinating because that's just starting to hit. And as everybody knows, you know, this whole stuff about kind of Thana technology and the way that immortality, like kind of this, the world of our present technology, especially with, you know, as it kind of gets turbocharged by AI, on the one hand, it has this thing about immediacy, and on the other hand, has this thing about eternality, right? Like, we're going to live forever, and we could also have it all right now, right? And so people kind of recording their loved ones for a kind of like AI consultation after they die and all this kind of stuff obviously has a very deeply ghostly aspect. And I'm kind of interested to see how that plays out according to these kind of discourses. My guess is that that's going to be very rich. I don't know exactly what it's going to be. So I'm involved, for example, in one project right now of making an AI replica of one of Singapore's most kind of famously organic and interpersonal performance artists. And there's a lot of question about what that means. You know, it's a little bit like going back to the religions where we thought that, you know, taking a photograph would steal somebody's soul. And the whole notion of the doppelganger and Freud and death masks and, you know, there's a lot of really rich cultural history that this is playing on. Obviously, it's almost like overdetermined that this is going to, you know, be something that plays into to ghost discourses. But it'll be very interesting. And I think your point about re-enchantment is very, very powerful. I mean, part of the reason that I worked on this book. I mean, I worked on this book mainly because I was working as an architect and all my job sites kept getting haunted. And I was like, why? Why is this happening? Why, you know, like, why is this affecting my work? I just want to get these buildings built. This is really irritating. And at the same time, I was beginning to do a kind of PhD in geography. So in a way, what started to happen was that it was, you know, coming out of that. But what was really interesting to me in that context was I was reading a lot of Weber, right? Max Weber. The notion was that we're supposed to be disenchanted. Singapore is supposed to be the most disenchanted, monetary, pragmatic kind of state that you could possibly. And that is its model, right? Is of the disenchanted secular state that should be kind of beyond this stuff. But then why are these bureaucracies so haunted? Right? Why is money so haunted? Why is the question of late capital so haunted? Why are we haunted by questions of risk, questions of volatility, questions of value that we can't explain? Stocks that go up for reasons we can't, you know, can't make sense of. Buildings that should sell all their units and don't, or look terrible and are worth a fortune. You know, the idiosyncrasies of modern life are exactly the kind of thing that lay themselves open to spectral explanations. And to me, a lot of those explanations were making a lot more sense than what we had with dominant ideas and, you know, economic theory. And so the question to me was, what do the ghosts have to tell us? And if they're not going away, in fact, they seem to be, according to, you know, members of Chinese religion in Singapore, only multiplying as a result of the project of development and modernization, then we need to start taking them very seriously.
Fascinating. You know, I was just thinking of another profession that must be, you know, really lucrative in Singapore. It's like being a condo lawyer, you know, the issue of like, you know, in Florida, you know, it's like which side of the wall is the mold on? And it's like, it would be like, where's the ghost? Like, is it right on your side of the drywall or my side of the drywall?
Right. Where is it?
Yeah.
And who does it belong to?
So Josh, this has been absolutely fascinating. It seems like a society that is really interested in managing risk of all types, and this is one that is quietly incorporated into the way of doing business, but not necessarily publicly acknowledged. And, well, we want to thank you for shedding some light on the Spectropolis today.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. It's always a pleasure to speak with you guys.